Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the UI Breakfast Podcast. I'm your host, Jane Fortman, and today our special guest is Brent Heckerman, the founder of Diffusion UX Design and Strategy, and we're going to talk about enterprise UX and collaboration for distributed teams. This episode is brought to you by Double Your Freelancing Conference, a conference for freelancers and agencies who want to get better at the business of consulting. It's located in Stockholm, Sweden, between 16th and 19th of June. You can find out more at doubleyourfreelancing.com/euconf. I'm speaking there too and would love to meet you in person. Hi, Brent.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me today.
We are thrilled to have you here. Thanks for making it.
No problem.
So we're going to start with a Blitz questionnaire so that we can learn about you before jumping into the main topic.
Sounds great.
Awesome. Brent, so what do you do for a living?
Well, at the moment, I've started my own consultancy in user experience. I'm working with different companies on design strategy. And at present, my main client is Realtime Board, who's a startup who's created a pretty interesting platform that I've used in my other experiences in work, and it's become the focus of my consulting.
Sounds great. What is your background story? How did you get to being a well-known UX consultant?
Well, it's kind of a long story, but I've been in the technology business for about 20 years. I started off as a technical writer for a few years and then went into UX design. I was working in telecoms for my first decade of work experience. Then I started working for different industries. And my last management job was with Nielsen. I had a roughly 20-size team of UX designers there that were distributed. So we had a lot of challenges that we faced with being a global company, trying to manage a design function across, you know, different regions, different geographies, and different disciplines, presented a lot of different challenges that I had the good fortune of thinking through and coming up with some solutions for. So for the past 6 years, I was managing that team at Nielsen, and since then, I've started my own LLC consultancy. I've been kind of using that learning to help startups get an edge in UX.
That sounds fantastic. What does your typical day look like?
Currently for Realtime Board, my current day looks like a lot of customer engagement. So a lot of my current work is working with customers who are adopting this collaboration platform, helping them understand use cases so they can better collaborate across distances. So most of the teams that we're working with are larger companies that have teams across the globe, and they're all faced with the same challenge, which is, how do we get our teams working efficiently and effectively together without spending lots of travel time trying to get into one room to do these kind of, you know, high output, high collaboration interactions? So a lot of phone time right now. Most of my work is virtual. We dial in. We use kind of video conferences like we're doing here, and we spend, you know, an hour or so exploring what the important problems to solve are for a customer, and usually they're team-related problems, like how do we get these multiple teams coming together to share or discover insights around different types of information, a lot of which tends to be visual. And with enterprises, there tends to be a lot of dependencies across different disciplines. So, you know, the problems start small with how do we talk, and they end up with kind of, you know, bigger problems of how do we compare information, how do we get everybody speaking the same vocabulary. And I think with these visual platforms that we'll talk more about, it is technology that helps collaborations become more effective.
So this is customer research. How does it translate into actual, you know, work that you do for Realtime Board? Do you produce, I don't know, mockups, deliverables, or do you just provide overall product guidance?
So since Real Time Board is a startup, most of the employees there wear 4 or more hats. As with most startups, and anybody out there who's in one knows what I'm talking about. So the other job I have is to help the UX team with their product development and help the product development team kind of with some of the practices. So some of that consultancy is just working with them on reviewing what they're doing, maybe giving some expert review of new designs that they're thinking through, especially from the enterprise side, because they are starting to build out some functions that are specific to administering larger teams. And then also, it's a young team, so they're learning very quickly how to become an effective product development team. And I would say that my inputs there are minimum, but because they're very fast, they're very thorough, they're very dedicated to what they're doing, and they've spent a lot of time learning. And I think they also have a very good learning culture in terms of looking at what they're doing and improving it as they go. So I'm kind of an expert voice there, just helping them more steer their product team.
Mm-hmm. Is that a typical role that you take in projects or for other clients or your own products? Do you do actual hands-on work? I'm just curious how much, expert guidance as opposed to hands-on work takes up in your life, or have you totally transitioned to guidance part?
Yeah. So in the consultancy on strategy side, most of it's guidance and less execution. I still do dabble in design, but it has moved more towards, working with younger teams who are learning the trade and kind of helping them develop the competencies. I guess that's what older people do in the industry. So, I feel like the design trade in general is kind of a young person's game, and things are changing so fast that I still love doing it, actually. But it's also become a lot more enjoyable to see, young talent rise up and improve their career and just learn new things and apply new tactics.
Mm-hmm. What do you enjoy the most and the least about your work?
Currently, I enjoy the variety of roles that I'm able to engage in. I think it's not a one-trick pony. So that I like. I think that's appealing to me because, I don't know, I guess I get easily bored, and I also like just really enjoy learning. And I think with multiple roles, you're always challenged with, figuring out new problems and also just learning new ways to communicate and problem solve. What I like least, it's almost 100% remote right now with a lot of my international customers, so although that's effective and it does kind of teach people that, virtual platforms can be effective tools, I do tend to miss, being in a room and being face-to-face with people, especially like international customers. It's so fun just to learn about new cultures and be there, that's not part of the experience of being a virtual consultant.
Mm-hmm. Brent, what is your next big thing? Maybe a book or another project? Personally, or maybe the next big thing at Real Time Board, that would be the right way to say it.
Well, Real Time Board's in an interesting place in its evolution. They're really, I think they've made their a big splash in terms of its visibility, and I think utility are really big with companies that are starting to adopt these platforms. And the next big thing for Real Time Board is just to get to the point where they are the premier, company doing this, producing this kind of a platform. And I think it's going from a startup to something bigger is the next big thing for them. And they're on the cusp of that. So it's pretty exciting to be helping them along that journey. For me, I think it's just more about developing my own business. So that looks to me more like getting in front of younger people at conferences, becoming a more visible spokesperson of my trade, and just really becoming more of a thought leader in the field versus a tactical person who does design execution.
Mm-hmm. All right, sounds fantastic. Now let's talk about actual teams. Let's go from the top level and let's imagine There's a startup who just got funded, and they have resources to hire a pretty large team, and they decided to make it remote. And let's say they have resources and have just hired 10 designers. How would you approach, from your expert standpoint, how would you start organizing such team if it's brand new?
Well, if it's distributed, so let's kind of break down the problem. I think there's this whole question of how to make lean practices work for startups, and you can throw a rock and hit an expert on that, right? There's lots of people out there that have done this and written books about it and presented at conferences and done it in their own careers. So, you know, I think the learning there is that a lot of those teams that are startups do prefer to have co-location. Like, that is the thing that makes them feel like they can all have the same vocabulary. They all share the same goals. You know, I think some examples are, if you look at the kind of Silicon Valley startup culture, the people that work for those startup companies tend to be like within striking distance. They can get into the office fast. They really require that kind of tactile vibrancy just to be in a space together and really produce something and sort of solve problems together. I think that's kind of in the DNA of what a startup is for a Silicon Valley, you know, type of engagement. If you wanted to take a small team and make it all distributed, I think you can be successful with that. I think you can be successful with distributed teams, whether they're large enterprise teams or even a small startup. So that you just have to ensure that the ground rules are in place. But if you want to talk about team, it's really important that no matter how separated you are geographically, that I think first and foremost that you kind of tear down the expectations that, you know, we're always going to be in one room together. So you have to start with trust. A team has to come together and learn how each other operates, start breathing the same oxygen. And I'd say, you know, get the team together, kick them off together, make them feel like they are developing some trust together, because you know they're going to go off into their separate geographies or time zones or even floors of a building or whatever it is that they're separated by, and they're going to start to, you know, be less of a team. So the first thing is just to get them together to kick off the company, the project that you're focused on for that quarter or for that year, and really try to develop an immediate sense of team glue and bonding.
So the idea is to get a physical retreat for them to get them to know each other personally before they start working.
If
that's possible.
Yeah, I think if you know your team's going to all be remote, then you have to work really hard to make them realize that they're real people that are all dedicated to the same thing. And the only way to do it is, you know, I think to really start off is to set a cadence. We're going to get together when we kick off. We're going to get together when we celebrate our successes. We might get together for retrospectives if we do those. That there are periods where you do plan to come together, but the majority of time where you're doing the work, it's going to be a distributed experience and remote.
Mm-hmm. From the structural point of view, so you've led multiple design teams throughout your career. Can you maybe give some insight what kind of roles people have there and how you structurally divide them? Maybe you think that the perfect way of doing things is splitting them up in little groups of 2-3 people, or maybe larger divisions or something like that. What is the best way of doing things from your standpoint?
I think it depends on the company's culture. So you might have cultures where a company culture where teams of 20 are the norm, and it's, you know, you're not going to get anywhere trying to change that dynamic, right? 20 is what they work with, and 20 is the number of experts they feel like they need to have a complete team, and you have to work with that. So I think on the design side of it, where the problems come in are, depending on the team size, you might have a small percentage of design people who are involved in that team who need to have a voice. And sometimes if they're outnumbered, it becomes an issue, especially with distributed teams, because there might be some folks who are actually in an office doing work together on a daily basis, and there might be some who are, and the rest might be scattered throughout home offices or different locations, and it becomes an equation of just visibility, right? So even if you have two designers on a team of 20, if they're not visible, if their voice isn't doesn't have authority or is not heard or is not frequently part of the important conversations, then it becomes less of an influencer and more of a just a participant as a design consultant or a team member. So I think it comes down to thinking about how important is it for the team to hear each other on a frequent basis, and what are the channels by which people do that? And it can come down to technology. Like right now, we're talking via, I thought it was Skype. I think we're on Zoom now. We changed a couple of times, but deciding the platforms for how people communicate, how visible those team members are, and what frequency they interact together. So I don't think there's a hard and fast kind of number or formula for it. It's more about trying to balance the team so that they have the right foundation to start collaborating effectively together.
How do you strike that balance between being visible and communicating constantly in touch and giving them creative time, that productive deep work time? How do you set the boundaries? Does it depend on the founder and their culture, or is it something that that there's an industry standard for?
Yeah, so I think it's a kind of multi-layered problem, right? So at one layer you have communication of how do we communicate as a distributed team. Is it just we have a chat system and we're all kind of something like Slack, right, where we're kind of getting constant messages from team members everywhere all the time? Is it some kind of more structured platform where we have meetings and we have ways to interact? Is it some kind of document structure where we're just doing, let's say we're producing some design specs and putting them in a Google Doc and using that through for a feedback and kind of review mechanism? So I think there's different layers of how we communicate that equate to visibility. I think when I think of visibility, it's more like, is my voice important to the team? Is my viewpoint, does it have the respect of the team? Do people trust that my perspective and experience are adding value to the conversation? And I think that technology is not the answer. We obviously have come to rely on things like Google Docs and collaborative documents like Microsoft, SharePoint, whatever, to feel like we're collaborating, because you produce a document, has some designs in it. I come in at some point in time and I'm looking at what you've produced, I'm reviewing it. We're not having a conversation, but we're having this kind of asynchronous exchange of ideas. And then I think what that leads to is just the sort of disjointed, okay, I've got five reviewers who have given me different perspectives. Now I have to kind of take those into my, synthesize those somehow into a response. And it's still a team working together to produce an outcome, but it's just really, the voices are kind of, the voices are so virtual that it's not an immediate impact, right? So I'm not seeing what you're thinking at the time you're seeing and saying it. So there is an immediacy thing. I think that in the design discipline, there's an immediacy factor that can help teams feel like they're in a room together, that there's more of a kind of a direct channel versus like these kind of distracting messages that always come in, like Slack can bombard you constantly. If you're on a Slack channel, you might have 10 Slack channels and they're constantly having some chatter going on. So there's this tension between how much information do I need for communication to be effective versus how much time do I need as an individual on a distributed team to do production work? Because at some point you have to just be able to crank out some content, right?
Mm-hmm. Is a team we all know that there are certain UX activities that are usually done in real time when people get together in a single room. That happens when, you know, new ideation happens, or when there is research organized, or when there is training. And these sessions are extremely hard to replicate in real life through Skype, screen sharing, etc., because it's just hard to replicate human interactions. I know you're good at such methods because you've done them a while. Can you give us a brief overview, maybe certain models, how such workshops can be held and sessions can be organized?
I can give you an example, a fairly recent example that might illustrate it. So I was working for a large company, and we were introducing some new tactics. And one of those tactics was early planning. And we wanted to do some customer journey mapping of a pretty long and rigorous process in their industry that they were trying to figure out how to problem solve and do some innovation for. They wanted to make basically shorten the process and use their software to improve their customers' planning capabilities. And it was really long. You know, it was probably one of the more complex journey maps I've ever done, and just happened to be the one that they were learning on. So it was the first time many of them had a chance to explore that technique for understanding a customer's experience. And it was also the first time that they really had a chance to sit down and really review these personas that we'd spent some time developing. And so there were kind of two things going on at one time. One was just introducing to the culture that there's a perspective on their customers that's different, that they can take to start doing their product design from. And the other was tactics. So tactics in this case happened to be journey mapping. And we had a room like everybody does. We had a very long, wide wall that was blank, and we had some butcher paper up and lots of different stickies and Sharpies, and we did the kind of routine design thinking approach of just mapping out these different journeys, exploring and doing discovery as we went along the way. And it was a team of about 12 to 14 people were in the room. They come from all over the place, all over the globe to be there. We spent 2 days doing the activity, and the results were great. I mean, I think we ended up with something new for the company to think about, a new tactic, but also I think the outcomes in terms of learning and applying a new tactic to their planning for product design was successful. So it was successful to the point that they wanted to repeat it as kind of a repeated practice for all the product design in that part of the company we were working in. But they looked at the cost of the journey map, and if you really calculated out how much it cost to be in that room, materials were pretty cheap. We had sticky notes and paper on the wall, but we had to digitize all that. We had to take it back to our different offices and sort of synthesize it and then represent it back. And overall, it was probably $70,000 to $80,000 journey map. And to take that cost and multiply that across all the different products they were building and all the different releases they wanted to do was prohibitive. And they realized the value of the activity, but they also realized the cost was going to be very difficult to justify, given where they were at that time in the company. So we started to explore. So we saw it as a collaboration problem, really. I mean, it ended up being, even in the room, collaborating on the problems we were trying to solve was hard. So now we're saying, look, we can't do this for every single project. We can do it for some of the really, really important ones, but the others are going to have some other way to accomplish the same ends. And we started to explore these collaborative visual platforms like real-time board and Mural, and there's a bunch of them out there right now, all doing kind of the same, providing the same kind of service, which is basically getting teams to feel like they're in front of a whiteboard together doing collaborative work. It's very visual. It's very tactile. Everybody's working in real time. And we spent about a quarter doing a pilot of several of these. The short story is, I know we need to be aware of time here. Short story is, we settled on one. We rolled it out to the product division that I was working in at the time, and it really did change how people worked. Not even, first of all, with the distributed teams, it helped because we could use that platform for, you know, feeling like we're in a room together anytime, anywhere we wanted to, without planning a trip, without doing all the, you know, the travel and entertainment, the T&E stuff you have to do, just the whole burden of like getting somewhere and getting to the room, retrieving the information, bringing it back and shaping it into another, you know, insight. That was expensive. So we started to see pretty quickly that the efficiencies were high in terms of just logistics. But I think more importantly, team members who had not collaborated deeply in a visual way before started to really get it. Like, it became a way to work that was pretty new to the company, but was really immediate. I think it provided immediacy to the team members who were, in some cases, may have not had a voice on the team in the past, but suddenly they were in this visual platform. They were able to share their ideas in a different way. And there were a few immediate quick benefits that made the platform to be of interest to lots of other parts of the company.
So I see the several immediate benefits from that versus dramatically lower costs than getting people together, especially from different countries. Mm-hmm. Another one is that the deliverable is digital, so you don't have that challenge of digitizing a huge wall of paper and sticker notes, which are absolutely tangible. Mm-hmm. We had a UX mapping workshop last year here at UI Breakfast, and one of the topics was how to actually process the results. And with digital tools, it becomes easier because it's the actual deliverable. It doesn't mm-hmm. have to be actually processed. But I would love to have your opinion on how to mediate, how to guide these meetings, because the dynamics of the team being in Skype or whatever tool you're using and synchronizing over digital real-time board is different than being in a room. How do you manage that?
It really depends on the tactics that you're trying to get the teams to learn. So if it's just journey mapping, then mm-hmm. it does require a few sort of best practices around digital platform collaboration. I think some of that is just being much more prepared for meetings than you might have normally been. So it's thinking about things in smaller chunks. So think about, like, you've got a platform where anybody on the meeting, let's say you have 20 people on the meeting, they can do anything they want to on the whiteboard. They can draw, they can put up stickies, they can look for pictures and pop those in, you know, and that can happen. So I think that the blank slate invites a lot of creative, open access. And you might want to discourage that. You know, if you have a very structured meeting, you'll have 2 hours to work together. You've got 20 people from different geographies. You're trying to accomplish a very specific task, which might just be solve a problem for a specific hypothesis. Then you have to have a very structured, facilitated approach to guiding that team through the tactic. So if it's a workshop where you're trying to get people to think up a visual idea for a landing page for your new app, and your goal is to gather as much, you know, kind of visual sketching ideas as you can in a short amount of time from a dozen people. So those, you could just say, okay, you have an hour, start drawing. And you might get a result, right? Mm-hmm. Or you could structure it in a way it's where you're kind of really guiding the activity through a thought process of really kind of creating a theory and then getting a result that's more focused around problem solving. So if you think about a whiteboard and, you know, sketching on a whiteboard and having post-it notes on a whiteboard, you can start to combine multiple tactics for sketching into one place. And I think sketching might be the last thing that you end up doing. But the idea is to get the team all thinking about the same problem and sharing vocabulary around what the issues are from the perspective of their customers, and then start to, you know, come up with some visual ideas about how it might be executed in a product design. So it's not just drawing blankly from your imagination. Is really kind of focusing in on what are the problems here. Is it that people don't understand like there's too much information on the page? Do we want to simplify it? Is there just lack of clarity about what the process is to get from A to B, so we need more instruction? You know, whatever it is that you think through that becomes part of your kind of thought experiment should then help people get guided more specifically down into a refined exploration for their visual design. And I think a lot of tactics like that in these visual platforms, it's good to have a facilitated experience when you first go through it. It's like a lot of design thinking workshops, if you've ever been to those. They're all very focused on an outcome, and they all have a very specific tactic to get to it. And they usually have like a time-boxed series of things that you do to achieve that outcome. Some of those could be you go off and do your own thing. Some of those could be that you're working in a sub-team. Some of those could be just like a brainstorming activity where you're coming up with lots of ideas. Some of that could be take those ideas and cluster those and break them down into the basic, you know, the basic themes, and then use those as your driving patterns for what you want to use as your solution. So I think to use these tools successfully, or to get teams introduced to them in a better way, you do have to have some basic ground rules for how to introduce them. One is just having good facilitation. Part of that is understanding how you want to break down the activities that you're trying to use to get to a good outcome. And I think maybe the first one is just understanding what tactics to use to begin with that translate well to the medium.
For example, let's imagine a company that's building a web application together, and there are a few designers in the team, maybe product manager, a developer, something like that. Can you call out, let's say, three most effective types of activities they can do together that are well represented by a digital workshop?
So when you, I think the first thing that usually happens with that kind of collection of, so it's like product engineering and UX coming together, is the question comes up, what are we doing? What do we really need to solve for? And that normally comes down to some kind of prioritization, right? Because I think if you asked anybody in the room, they might want to start first on a specific thing that's either more fun to do or more interesting to do, or maybe it's not the thing that the customer needs to have first, right? Maybe it's just the thing they want to do because of other reasons. Maybe it's just easier to execute. So I think one of the first things that's easy to do with these teams in a white space is just prioritization. Like, what are we doing? How do we get it? How do we get a start? You know, how do we even begin the project, right? We have so much backlog. We have so many things to tackle. Where do we go? And there's some pretty interesting kind of democratized features on and things like Real-Time Board and Mural and others that let teams vote. So you can take votes on, let's say you've set up your stickies and you've got, you know, you kind of rank things down. Okay, now we have the top 20. And you can start to get some voting in that that helps the team feel like they're sort of more naturally doing prioritization versus like, you know, we're interested in this or we're politically need to do this because, you know, someone prefers this first. That you can let the team voice kind of come through these voting features, which are either anonymous or not anonymous, but you can kind of vote on ideas via the stickies that are organized on the white space. So I think prioritization is a big one. I think in enterprises we see that a lot, even with companies that are using larger other platforms like Atlassian's Jira platform. There's like lots of prioritization features in those tools as well that let you look at stories and epics and user stories and try to figure out, you know, how do we scale these so we can execute fast? And the visual platforms let you do that in a pretty fluid way. So you can kind of move things around quickly. You can see where you have duplicate ideas and kind of strike through those quickly. So there's a speed of kind of visual engagement, I think, that helps get teams started more, you know, on the right foot, or at least in a get into agreement about where to start more quickly.
Mm-hmm. So example number one, which you just described, is feature prioritization and voting of them, which is mm-hmm. wonderfully facilitated. What other two examples can you give us?
So lots of tactics in UX can be executed in these platforms. I think one that's great for that dynamic of teams, you have product, you might have product owners, you might have engineers and UX people working together to problem solve. You can also do a persona exploration through these platforms, and which is, I think it's a nice way to do it because it's not like you're, in a lot of cases, you publish a persona and it's like this, you know, published thing that can't be changed. It's like, this is the persona. And the visual platforms that, and what I've seen in practice is when you use this platform, like it's like a whiteboard. So it's not like a published tome that has a version and an edition. It's like a continually growing piece of information that's informing your current state of awareness about what to do. So persona activities, I think, are another great one that you can use white spaces to help teams learn about customer problems, and also even, you know, share in the research and understanding that went into developing the personas, so that you're kind of educating the team across the board about what's important and how your customers are thinking about your products. So I think that engagement of getting engineers and product owners in UX together in those kind of activities is really important.
How would you structure such workshop or session? So that would be huge whiteboard and different sections dedicated to different personas, and people start throwing in their input, you know, maybe on sticky notes or something in those dedicated areas. Is that the right way I'm imagining that?
Oh, maybe. It depends on how much research you've done. So If you want to start the workshop with just doing like a basic review of what you already know about your customers, it could be a very quick way to bring teams together and start to really formulate a theory around who your customers are if they've never done it before. A good starting point might just be, look, we're going to do internal discovery about what we already know about or think we know about our customers. And use that forum. Just use a white space, throw up a few personas. Like maybe you have someone who's, you know, a C-suite executive, and you have someone who's a marketing director, and you have somebody who's in production doing product development, and you want to understand, how do we make a product that works for these three kinds of people who are going to be using it? And what do we know about them today? So you could probably do a two-hour workshop where you just get insights from different stakeholders about what they think. I would call that a proto-persona. I think that's a pretty common term that's out there today. And if you really want to develop a persona that's research-based, then it probably is you have some UX researcher or product developer, product owner who's done some interviews, done some observations, who's taking that and, you know, and shared that back to the stakeholders. And I've seen our teams do this in different companies, is they, you know, use the whiteboard to actually do a research review. Like, here's what we've really learned through interviews. Here are some verbatims. Here's some actual data. Here are the themes that we've discovered, you know, this quarter about what's really happening in the market. And you can use that for a research review in a pretty rich and informative way. And also, I think you can get people engaged at that point too, because you could use voting to say, okay, here's the five top themes that we discovered in the research, you know, prior to Q1. What should we focus on? Where's the biggest pain that we want to solve for? So even in the research review, you can kind of make it an interactive experience that brings team members on board in a way that I think is hard to do without this kind of visual engagement.
What would be, I'd love to hear one more use case, just sure, because these are precious for our listeners.
Well, I'll go back to journey mapping. Because a journey map is a visual tool to begin with. And what we almost always find out with when we're doing journey maps is, especially in enterprise where you have potentially customers using pretty complex systems, the journey maps can be lengthy. They can be lengthy and painful, arduous journeys. And to understand it, you just have to have room to be able to express it. So I've been in meetings in rooms with, you know, trying to utilize a whole wall where we didn't have enough space. We had to kind of add on, you know, and do the right turn, right? The 90-degree turn to the next wall. And I think the beauty of these, you know what I'm talking about, where you're kind of walking the wall, but you're trying to create a map that's intelligible and is a full picture of what some users' experiences are. And I think with the virtual platforms, it's endless, so you can do whatever you want. And that kind of frees you up to not feel constrained, not feel like you're reducing your thinking just because there's a wall coming up, you know. So journey mapping with the tools becomes, I think it becomes easier to do. It also becomes more immediately accessible because, as you've probably experienced, if you're not right in front of the wall where the sticky notes are being written, you can't read anything that's on them. But if you're in front of your laptop or tablet or whatever you're using to access the canvas, you can read everything immediately that's being written and posted, and it's just a more immediate awareness and I think level of engagement with the content that you're trying to develop as a team.
Exactly. So there are some difficulties in facilitation, for example, that are caused by the fact that everything is digital, but also there are some amazing opportunities that don't exist in real world, for example, unlimited whiteboard space and many more. You mentioned voting. Could you walk us a little bit through those unique features in real-time board, for example, that are not so easy implemented in real world, but can be used to your benefit in a digital workshop?
Sure. I think the voting feature becomes a kind of a fun and really kind of high utility feature for large teams, especially in enterprise when you have lots of different teams with different dependencies and different points of view about what to tackle first. You might have engineers that have a preference for doing things that, you know, take the easy shots first kind of approach. And then you might have product owners who have other priorities coming at them from, you know, directly from customers saying, we need this kind of feature coming at us right now. And I think voting helps to kind of quiet those conversations down because suddenly you're not arguing about who's right. You're just kind of getting the team consensus about where to start. So the way voting works is it's sticky note based. So in the digital platforms, there's a virtual sticky note, and you can do certain things to it. I mean, beyond like just shaping it and, you know, giving it a specific color, changing the font sizes and all that stuff. You can also add emojis to it. So we use emojis to do voting. So kind of like all the popular, like, you know, if you like it, there's a heart or the smiley face or whatever. But what it does, it takes the emojis that you set up as your voting system. It could be a smiley, could be a frowny face. And if I were to put a smiley face up and five people voted for it, you could see the tallies going up on the sticky note. So presumably the sticky note's an idea that could be a feature or a prioritized task in your project. And through the voting, you can kind of see quickly as a team what we've democratically voted on doing versus what's been argued to be the prioritized thing.
Mm-hmm. So voting is one great feature. Mm-hmm. I'm terribly curious how the endless white space is organized, whether there's, I don't know, how can you give it structure to it so I can store the board, or, I don't know, access different parts of it? Or is it just truly endless and white?
I always think of the comparison to Notepad. Mm-hmm. So Notepad's just is nothing but an empty space to write in, and there's no structure to it. I mean, you can change the font sizes, you can change fonts, but it's just like Notepad and apply that to any visual forum. So it's as structured as you want it to be. You know, there's some companies I've worked with who really kind of freak out at the open-ended nature of it because they're like, well, our teams can't possibly succeed with this because there's no structure to it. And the answer to that is to provide structure. So I think there's a lot of, I go back to design thinking because design thinking has lots of very structured, kind of formalized tactics that, you know, are timed, and it's a very good fit for these platforms because they're all collaboration based tactics. So if you take a tactic like I mean, I got to think of one now. Just brainstorming, right? So brainstorming usually starts off with a cue. Usually it's a hypothesis, or it's like, we're solving for this problem kind of statement. And it's like a very focused statement about what you're trying to achieve, you know, or focusing on for the brainstorm. It's not like, think about everything and that's your brainstorm. It's usually like, solve for this problem or think about this problem and give your top five ideas for, you know, a possible solution. So just that in itself, just providing a prompt, you can just type it into the page, to the board, and that can be a space where you designate brainstorming to start. And if you can also use, depending on how structured you want to be with your team, let's say you have 10 people and they're all collaborating on some problem-solving issue, you can create a little swim lane for each of the participants, and that could be their specific workspace. And that's where they're actually doing their ideation, their new ideas, they're coming out in stickies, or they're doing their sketches in that swim lane. Or you could just give them their own special spot. You know, that this is where you're going to do your work and where we're going to refer to it when we review it, when you want to discuss it, we'll all Zoom to you and look at it. So it just depends really on how fluid you want the facilitated experience to be versus how free you want the teams to be and where they're working and what they're doing. I'll say the other thing about the structure part of it is it's also very nice because you, like a lot of design thinking tactics might be intended for large teams, and then you have like a sub-team that breaks out and does a specific, you know, deeper dive on something. You can just send them to a different part of the white space and say, okay, team B, you're going over here. This is where you're going to solve for 10 minutes, work on this problem. So you can also do that. You can just kind of direct people to parts of the virtual space to do work. And then other teams like marketing teams, I found just like to have a blank canvas. You know, they don't require the structure. They just want to have pictures and visuals and they're used to that. So some of it has to do with what teams are used to doing already as, you know, translating what they do on a whiteboard to the white space. Others have to do with, in terms of flexibility, their willingness to just, you know, work in a blank space. A lot of people get nervous about that. Like, it's like the paralysis of a white page, right? Some people can't write a word because they're afraid to start. So I think having a facilitated experience usually means there's a structure. Someone's created some visual path to doing things. It could be step one, step two, step three. They have a time limit to them, and it's all very laid out, or it could just be five people on a blank board going crazy. You know, it just depends on how people work together. That's the beauty of it. It's a flexible thing that I think that can accommodate different work styles.
Can you recommend any resources, maybe books or blogs, where UX designers can get inspiration for such activities, maybe workshops, scenarios they can implement with their teams?
You know, I wish you'd asked me that before we started recording, because I'm going to draw a blank right now. Yeah, I read a lot of them, but I have to go and do a little bit of remembering after our session ends and send those to you.
How about we do that and I include those resources in the show notes?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Let's do this, because I'm sure, I mean, we get the idea, but yeah. The actual scenarios would be fantastic. And I have one last question about the facilitator role. I see you've been in these shoes multiple times, but who is that person who facilitates the workshop usually? Does it require special training, special abilities, or do you just grow into those shoes with time?
I think it does require, there's a certain competency to facilitation. It's just like being a trainer. I mean, if you've ever done any training, without understanding how to communicate to a class, how to structure the instructional content, how to get feedback, how to give responses to, like, if someone's sketching, you know, you want to kind of go over and do a little bit of critiquing and help them understand where they are with their. So there's lots of different little tactics that I think, or competencies that are important to facilitation. And I think doing it virtually, there's another layer of competencies, which is about, a lot of it's about, you know, thinking about the digital platform, just like, how are people seeing each other? How are they hearing each other? And how do I structure activities in a way that ensures that people aren't multitasking, right? Checking their phone or their Slack or their whatever. So keeping activities very, you know, very short, like 2 or 3 minute activities. Learning those tactics, I think, are just things that you end up, you know, helping you become a better facilitator virtually. That probably also translate to a real world if you're in a classroom type of environment. But there are kind of special considerations for just being virtual. The big ones are, you know, just make sure everybody can get to it, to the platform you're using. They can be heard. They can be, you know, they can be they can see the screen shares. And then I think also then just having a very kind of structured facilitation approach is also important. I think you know, the bottom line is that these platforms should enable collaboration like an optimizer, right? It's not like it's a solution to making all teams be the best collaborators in the world, but it is an optimizer to teams that have challenges with being distributed.
Absolutely. One more practical question. So during these workshops, all the members are on some kind of call together usually, or can it be done asynchronously?
So it's a good question. I think the chances of everyone who needs to be on the call in an enterprise at, you know, at any given time are and getting them all on a call are low. It's really hard to find every time zone, every, you know, important stakeholder, everybody getting there at the same time. So what we often do is just we'll record the session and then we'll make it available to those participants, any participant who was on the call, and those who couldn't make it can review the video, and usually it has audio and video, and you can kind of see exactly what happened with a summary of the kind of outcomes is how we've done it in the past. But yeah, definitely it's a real-time experience. So if you have one person and facilitating and one collaborator, you know, and the rest of the team is off to other meetings, it's not effective. You have to have a quorum of collaborators to make these effective.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Yeah. Well, yeah. Brent, thank you so much for sharing that wisdom. I'm sure everyone now wants to try these new tactics and new tools for real-time collaboration. Where can people find you online?
Well, LinkedIn is the easiest way right now. Just Brent Heckerman on LinkedIn. And I think if you want to check out anything about real-time board, specifically in terms of, you know, how different use cases, different case studies, you can go to our blog at Real-Time Board, and that's a good kind of first stop. And we'll probably link this podcast to that as well.
Thank you so much, Brent. That was really useful, and I wish you good luck in organizing remote teams.
Thanks, Jane. I really appreciate having time to talk to you today.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. Take care.